This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of All Football Commentators Are Geeks with me, Michelle Owen from Sky Sports and Soccer Saturday.
Alex Crook from TalkSport, a national newspaper journalist.
And me, Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV.
This week, BBC and ITV commentator and presenter Jackie Oatley tells us about her unusual career change.
A recruitment agency which found me a job in intellectual property. And it was interesting, I got to travel, I got to meet new people, but it wasn't fulfilling and it wasn't sport. And every Saturday afternoon, I would travel around the country to watch my beloved football team home and away from London. And on a Sunday, I would play.
As well as Jackie, this man joins us to talk about the cat that got the cream.
Where has this cat come from? He looks quite brave. He's in the penalty area. He's making a run towards goal, this black cat now. Is he going to end up in the back of the net? No, he's just gone wide.
Michelle will also give us a unique insight into Maurizio Sarri's bizarre dressing room lock-in last week.
Sam will tell us about his emotionally charged trip to Cardiff on Saturday.
And we'll have Crook's origin story, including how he got his big commentary break over a bottle of whiskey.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Yeah, that's a true story, actually. It did all start over a bottle of whiskey. And when you hear it later, I will, at the end, make sure that it is fact-checked and you've got the real story, because I know what he's like. By the way, he is not here today, okay?
No.
So when you hear his voice today, if you're listening to this on Wednesday or Thursday, whenever it is you're downloading the pod, thank you very much for downloading it. But he's on a beach or a sun lounger with a bottle of Sagres, doing no work, okay? So me and Michelle are slogging it out, right?
Yes, this is correct.
And he is somewhere else not doing anything. He sent us a couple of voice notes.
He has had so many holidays in the football season as well. Didn't he get married in the football season?
Yeah.
And then he had his honeymoon in the football season.
Correct.
And he's got a week off in Portugal.
Unbelievable. And I think you've only known him for a little while. And you immediately sent, when he said, oh, I'm a bit busy next week, I'm in Portugal, you said, you have more holidays than the Queen.
This is true. This is true. And all I'm saying is he is doing very well. He's not inviting us on these holidays, Sam. He's not inviting us.
He must be doing very, very well. That's all we can say. How was your weekend, okay?
Yeah, fine. Recovering from deadline day, which was the coldest deadline day I've ever known. And then,
I saw you in the snow. It was hilarious. I was in a warm studio and I was looking at you and I was thinking, oh, she's cold.
Yeah. And I was actually really unwell on Friday. I've never called in sick in my time with Sky Sports. I was 10 minutes from the Cardiff presser that I was on my way to when I had to call in sick. My cameraman was unwell as well, frozen to the core. But no, it was all good. Was back in action Saturday at Bristol City. So that was all good. Who are on an amazing run still. Maybe dark horses for a promotion from the Championship. Mm. We'll see.
Lee Johnson's your mate again now, isn't he?
Yeah, BFFs.
Okay, before we go any further, let's look at the main stories from the weekend in numbers since we were last with you. Tottenham left it late again to beat Newcastle 1-0 at Wembley. Did you know that Maurizio Pochettino could double the pay packet of his entire first team squad, buy seven new players and still have a lower wage bill than Manchester City?
Incredible. And just to think how close they are to them in the table as well. Wolves heaped more misery on Crook's mate Marco Silva with a 3-1 win at Everton. The Midlanders have only used 18 players this season, fewer than any other Premier League club.
Manchester United maintained their 100% away record under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer with a 1-0 win at Leicester. The Norwegian is the first United boss since Sir Alex Ferguson retired to win five successive matches on the road.
Sergio Aguero hit his 10th Premier League hat-trick as Manchester City thrashed Arsenal. The Argentine needs just one more treble to equal Alan Shearer's record in the competition.
Fulham made a piece of unwanted history as they were beaten at Crystal Palace, the first ever Premier League side to lose eight consecutive London derbies.
Gonzalo Higuain became the first Chelsea player to score on his Stamford Bridge debut since Mario Stanic 19 years ago as the Blues batters Huddersfield 5-0.
Yeah, I'm not sure that really counts, though, if you beat Huddersfield 5-0 when you've lost 4-0 to Bournemouth and you've lost 2-0 away at Arsenal. Ultimately, you can say what you like, but greater tests are to come for Maurizio Sarri. And I think that, you know, you guys were down at Bournemouth in midweek when he locked everybody in the dressing room. It was a surreal thing to do because he kicked out the coaching staff as well. And there was a weird moment, Michelle, wasn't there, when you were standing outside and they were trying to listen at the door.
Do you know what? I was more annoyed that I just wanted to go home, to be honest. It's the longest I've ever waited to go and do post-match down in Bournemouth. And yeah, I think some of the staff were hovering outside the door. Some were just moving towards the door, trying to get a better listen of what was going on. You can imagine it, can't you? Ears pressed against the door, wondering what was going on. I interviewed Cesar Azpilicueta after, wouldn't let on anything, of course. Waited an hour and I'd say just over an hour for that. Did Dave Brooks on the final whistle, and just over an hour later. So they caused me to get home at 2 a.m. So thank you, Maurizio Sarri. But clearly whatever he said had an impact, because they went out and did the business at the weekend. But wow, they were poor at Bournemouth.
It's an odd situation. It doesn't happen very often.
To lock everyone out. Yeah, really bizarre.
And I suppose it was gossip central in that tunnel whilst that was going on, because everybody knew what was happening. It was it couldn't be kept a secret, because they're, especially at Bournemouth, it's all very tight down there, isn't it?
The thing is, all of the journalists and reporters are in this one little room, and then there's a double door through to the tunnel of the changing rooms. Now, not everyone has a pass, but I had a pass. So I was flitting in and out just to see what on earth was taking so long. Meanwhile, you had some anxious floor managers who were getting a little bit uppity about the situation, but it's not like they could just go in there and tell Sarri to hurry up. The club will have been fined, I would imagine, because you have to come out in a certain window. When they get fined, I believe that money goes to charity. So I guess that's something good to come from it. But I'd say there was about 9 or 10 of us, reporters and journalists, waiting to speak to Sarri and Cesar Azpilicueta after. And just in the end, it got a bit boring, to be honest. I know it sounds quite dramatic and
His interview was rubbish. I'm not saying that from your point of view. He didn't say anything. So we've waited all this time. You're desperate, obviously, to get the interview. You think he's going to come out and say something explosive, which he did do in the game against Arsenal. He came out and it was all guns blazing, and he was very much sort of like, these players are difficult to motivate. I don't know what the issue is. He didn't really say too much in that interview. I listened to Crook's interview. Crook did a really good one, actually. He kept going on and on and on and on and on until the press officer in the end just said to him, "All right, Alex, that's enough now," and just made him walk off. But he kept going, at least. But he wanted to get something out of it, because actually, you know,
wait so long.
Mad.
And same with Cesar Azpilicueta. I can never say his name. Cesar Azpilicueta.
Azpilicueta.
There you are. he said absolutely nothing either. He stood there with his posh wash bag. He did look very tired. He just sort of said then they'd been speaking men to men. I was like, well, what does that mean? I speak woman to woman. You know, it's just, it was stuff just to fill time. And when you've waited that long, you want to get something out of it. So credit to Crook for going at it. And I understand why the press officer was annoyed, because they'd had to wait ages as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think I drove out of Bournemouth about 11:10. So it was a late one.
I was at an emotional Cardiff City Stadium on Saturday, where the fans paid tribute to Emiliano Sala. Neil Warnock in tears at the final whistle as he went round the pitch. I think he found it all a bit too much to deal with. Been a bit of a tough time for him. The atmosphere was really good, actually. I thought what they did on Saturday was really well planned and brilliantly put together by Cardiff City. He's had to front up the fallout to this. He's also had to then afterwards communicate with the families. I had to read all the emails that came out over the weekend that seemed to suggest the agent didn't really have the interest in the player that he claimed to have before the transfer. Maybe Neil has had to deal with that side of it too. It's a very tough situation, especially for the family. The fans were great. I think Neil handled himself very well. It's actually quite a tricky one to cover, because you have to pitch it just right. You don't want to be too somber and melodramatic. You've got to be respectful. It's logistically very different as well, because if you know, we do a radio program like this every single week. We start at the same time. The kickoff is the same time. There are certain bits of furniture that you have to put in during that period that we've signed contracts about, that are sponsored commercially, blah, 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 blah. But because there was a silence, because the players are walking 2 minutes earlier than beforehand and coming onto the pitch, you've got to put a little bit of thought into how you handle it so you don't sort of over-talk whilst the silence is going on or while the players are coming out. You've got to make sure that you get the timings right. So we had to move the front of the programme a little bit, so the logistics are a bit difficult from a broadcasting point of view as well. The game itself, absolutely ridiculous. Bournemouth 8 defeats in a row on the road now, the most compliant of visitors. It beggars belief that it was basically the same team that beat Chelsea 4-0, except, of course, for the wonderful David Brooks. Very weird.
He's such a good player. But they were missing him, weren't they? So yeah. What I'd say about Neil Warnock, just a final word on that, is, you know, I wouldn't say I know him really well or anything, but I've known him reasonably well since he came to Cardiff a couple of years ago. And I know he gets a lot of stick from fans. And I sort of tweeted on Saturday evening after seeing him cry, honestly, like, how could you not have a lump in the throat after seeing that? But I tweeted about that. And fans were sort of coming back, you know, saying stupid, ludicrous things. But also a lot of it was sort of predetermined with, I'm not a fan of him, but. But it's not about, like, being a fan of him or not. It's just seeing, like, a fellow person so distressed with what's gone on. When have you ever seen Neil Warnock cry?
I never have.
I just wonder now as well whether he will retire at the end of the season. Because he used to say, you know, football was his escape. And then obviously his wife had cancer and, you know, she wanted him out of the house and he got back into football management. He's retired goodness knows how many times. But I just wonder now if this is it. You know, it puts everything into perspective, doesn't it? And just, he's such a nice man to deal with. And I know he's got a bad rep. And like I said, don't know him very well. But what I do know of him, it was just so, so sad to see him upset. And, you know,
I think he conducted himself really well after that. He did go into an interview room, though, and try and find Gary Lineker, didn't he, though?
I saw that. I was like, oh, God. I just saw the video on Twitter the next day. I was like, oh, my gosh.
He was after Gary.
But, you know, like his name was made to be an acronym of something else. Colin. Say the other bit.
And then the other word that rhymes with banker.
I didn't realise it offended him so much.
One of the more upbeat stories unfolded at Goodison Park over the weekend, and Everton fans have not said that very often. It centred on a feline intruder, which was covered live on the BBC.
Fully grown cat going towards the substitutes. The substitutes stand and wait, drops the shoulder, jinks one way, then the other. The cat's still going. Left wing, running towards the bench now, this cat, towards Nuno Espirito Santo, who stands arms folded, laughing. The cat drifts on.
John Akers was the reporter at the heart of that scene. What's new, pussycat?
Don't you start.
I bet you've had a busy week, haven't you? How did that all come about?
I'll tell you what, it's been absolutely crazy. It came about, Sam, because I wasn't concentrating. You know when you're doing a game, right, and a report and a presenter will throw to you and you're not looking at the actual game, you're looking at your notepad, at some notes, or you're writing something, being there?
We've all been there.
We've all been there. That is what happened. Jason said, there's a cat on the pitch at Goodison. John Akers. I was staring at an A4 piece of paper, mate, with some notes on. I've looked up, and that's when I've gone, so where has this cat come from? Literally, it's thinking on your feet time. I've got nothing prepared. I've just done an update on the state of the game. So I think, you know, in that moment where you think, well, I've got to say something, I just started commentating on what the cat was doing. And I think anyone who's ever done live reporting knows, a commentator, you just start talking, and that is what came out. There was no conscious decision to do it. That's what came out.
John, it was genius. I absolutely loved it. When I saw the clip later on, and obviously you set off a world of cat puns the next day, but everyone was talking about your commentary. Did you have a cat? Where did all this come from? It was fantastic.
I have. You're not going to believe this, right? But my girlfriend Amber is obsessed with cats. We have 5 cats.
No.
And she, honestly, and she wants 10. So I am used to watching cats walk about the place. I mean, obviously not on the football pitch, but it kind of combined 2 big areas of my life, football and cats. And I just once I'd started,
that was it.
I thought it'd be on. I thought it'd be on the pitch for 10 seconds, didn't you? I thought it'd get startled, run off. But it felt safest. It felt safest on the pitch, away from the crowds, didn't it?
Yeah.
So it just kept going, and then I thought, well, I'm in it now. I've got to carry on.
I feel like that you walk around your house commentating on your cats. But what I really want to know is, you may not know this because I saw that it sort of went out of the ground, but is the cat okay?
Do you know what? I spoke to the owner of the cat this morning.
Oh, my
Gary.
God. No way.
So you're getting a bit of an exclusive here on the pod. So this morning, Gary came forward, thanks to BBC Radio Merseyside, and said, that's my cat. And we let him out for the afternoon. It's the whites, really, you know. So we've let him out, and I watched Match of the Day, and the cat's on the sofa, and I'm looking at the cat, and I'm looking at the game, and I'm looking at the cat, and I'm thinking, that's my cat! And he lives in the terrace houses behind Goodison.
Yeah.
And said that the cat was called Jack, and was a really quite a brave, outgoing cat. He's one of these that you could be stroking, then he'll turn around and bite you at any moment. And is a real character of a cat. So the cat is fine. It's got a loving home.
Oh, that's good news.
This is fantastic.
I'm delighted to hear that about the cat. And my favourite bit of the interview, the commentary, was when you started talking about Nuno Espirito Santo and his glare at the cat. And he was standing there with his arms folded. And then you spoke to him afterwards, didn't you? And he was saying, I don't ever want to see a black cat again.
That's because it's unlucky in Portugal. But as we know, here in the UK, it's good luck, especially if a cat crosses your path from left to right, as it did with Nuno. Now, one flaw in that logic is it also passed Marco Silva from left to right as well, who we, of course, know had no luck whatsoever.
And
hasn't that
had any luck for a long time.
Goal.
He must have been seeing quite
exactly.
A few black cats. Well, listen, it gave everybody a bit of joy and it maybe cheered up a few Everton fans who obviously haven't had much in recent periods. So, listen,
do you know
thank
what?
You
we do have a go at social media, Sam, don't we, Michelle, sometimes? And, you know, people say horrible things on there and there are trolls galore. But all I've had from social media after this is just joy. It made people smile, it made people laugh. And there's so much in the world to be miserable about. And it's February and it's cold. And it's just brought a smile to people's faces. And that has been just brilliant. I've loved it. It's been great. Obviously, not great for my career. You know, credibility low, exposure high. But it has been nice seeing people smiling about it.
That's how I deal with dancing on ice, mate. Don't worry.
You're brilliant on that show. You're brilliant.
Thanks for coming on, John.
No worries, Sam. Bye, Michelle.
Thanks, John. I feline that was a very good story. Thank you very much. I did spend all my shift on Sunday, every time that story came around on Sky Sports News, thinking as many cat puns as I could. I was very proud of myself.
Dear.
Anyway,
was that to stroke your own ego?
Oh, that's good a good
on that.
One.
Good. Lap it up.
I was identifying the perpetrator. Okay, right. Let's move on. You are listening to All Football Commentators are Geeks. I'm sorry about that. Coming up next, Crook will go from asking the questions to answering them. As I asked him about how he went from playing Sabutio in his dining room to commentating on the World Cup.
And we'll have Jackie Oakley very shortly.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.
This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks and our favourite part of the show where we're joined by one of our commentary box colleagues. This week, I'm delighted to say we caught up with Jackie Oakley from BBC and ITV Sport and she's with us now. Hello, Jackie.
Morning, Sam.
Great to have you on the podcast. And I know that you've been listening up as you've been driving up and down the country. I've been listening to you actually recently because of all the political stuff that's been going on. I've become addicted to Radio 4's Today programme. And you've been reading The Sport recently on that programme. That's an iconic news programme which goes out every day in the UK. And what does it feel like working with people like John Humphreys in the morning?
Yeah, it's different. It's very different to being surrounded by football people, as I normally am, and darts people, as I will be this weekend. But it's just great to do different things. And I think that's the joy of this kind of job, isn't it? Is that one minute you are at a side of a football pitch or in a commentary box, and the next minute you're wondering whether the Prime Minister is going to walk in and talk about Brexit. So it's the nature of the job, but yeah, it's fun doing a variety of things, and I love all of it.
Jackie, we met, I'm sure you remember, a few years ago in Richmond Park with the lovely Ellie Oldroyd, who I know has been so kind to us both, and
as a woman trying to get into sport and into football commentary at that point, we sat down, we had lunch together, and you had some invaluable advice for me. But not everyone will know how your journey started. And you sort of had a standard 9-to-5 job, didn't you? If you could just share with everyone how you made that jump from, as many people I know would love to do, from a job in an office to being a football commentator and a sports broadcaster and TV presenter.
So for me, it was a case of doing a degree, travelling around the world for a year, thinking, what do I do now? Don't know. Joining an agency, a recruitment agency, which found me a job in intellectual property. And it was interesting. I got to travel. I got to meet new people. But it wasn't fulfilling. It wasn't sport. And every Saturday afternoon, I would travel around the country to watch my beloved football team home and away from London. And on a Sunday, I would play for a Greater London League side. And I got my football fix that way, but it wasn't really fulfilling at all because I knew that I really wanted to work in sport, but I had no idea how to do it. I didn't know people who did it. I didn't have any friends, family, neighbours, anybody who could point me in the right direction at the time. So it was only really when I injured my knee badly and was told I couldn't play again, I thought, right. And I took another job while I was in the process of waiting for this operation, and on 10 months on crutches. And I was so frustrated that I couldn't go to football, I couldn't play football, although I was still going on crutches to watch. And I decided that I needed to try and find a way into it. So I did loads and loads of research on the internet. I looked at how other broadcasters had got in. I read all their biographies online, and I saw that Pete Stevens of BBC London had done hospital radio. So I signed up to Charing Cross Hospital and started doing sports reports on there after asking all the old people for their song requests. And then I did other evening courses, Introduction to Print Journalism, which I found out about via going to WH Smith and Floodlight magazine. So that was one class a week as well, and did another class in radio production, which I found out about via hospital radio. So I did all this for 6 months, and I thought, right, this is definitely what I want to do, sports broadcasting, journalism. But how do I go from a job that's fairly well paid, but something I don't want to do, into something that, frankly, loads of people, thousands of people want to do, and who are all qualified to do it? And I had a German degree, no sports journalism background at all. So I decided to give up my job, give up my flat, throw absolutely everything at it, had nowhere to live, had no income, spent a week at a time on friends' floors, taking a bag of pillows and a sleeping bag and what have you, and belongings around London, around the country, and did full-time work experience. Started at Haters News Agency for a couple of days and a bit of BBC WM, and eventually decided that if I'm going to do this properly and actually get a job and do it properly, then I'd need to get a qualification because I couldn't just find any jobs without one. So moved up to Sheffield, left everything, left my boyfriend, started as a mature student at Hallam University, which is the only place that had any places left by the time I decided to apply. And again, threw everything at it, worked extremely hard, much harder than I did for my undergraduate degree, wrote to all the local BBC stations while I was at Sheffield saying, hi, I'm a mature student, I'm in a hurry, can I come in? And BBC Leeds got back to me and gave me 2 days of work experience on TV news. Now, I wanted to do radio sport, but it was a brilliant thing to do. And while I was in there, after fainting on my first day, I still don't know why, in the middle of the newsroom, I went out on a Leeds United story with a news reporter who didn't know anything about football. And I happened to know all the story about Peter Ridsdale and all the financial difficulties about Leeds. So I helped him with that. And then collared the sports editor while I was in the newsroom and said, look, I'm really keen to do radio sport. Can I come in and see you? And he said, well, actually, we've got nobody to do the non-league, so if you want to come in for a voice test, we can take it from there. So I jumped at that, went in, and started doing a 10 to 15 minute slot on a Saturday, Radio Leeds, while I was still a student in Sheffield on my postgrad. And absolutely loved it. And the West Yorkshire non-league football scene became my domain. That became my patch, and made sure I got to know everybody, spent every night going out and watching matches at Ossett Albion. Bradford Park Avenue was my first reporting match when my boss gave me a chance there. It was absolutely terrifying in one of those glass-cased boxes miles away from the pitch, and with all these old guys from local Yorkshire newspapers looking at me, thinking, who's this blonde bird with a clipboard and a massive brick of a mobile phone? And I just worked and worked and worked and worked, and I found that the harder I worked, the more opportunities arose.
And obviously when you first started, there weren't so many female voices on television and radio. I think that's certainly changed over the years. But has it changed significantly enough for you? Because I know you've got involved in debates about female voices commentating on the World Cup and some criticism from the likes of Piers Morgan and Jason Cundy. Are you surprised that people's opinions on female voices and female commentators hasn't modernised, really? You're still fighting the same battles perhaps you were when you first started.
To a certain extent, I think things have definitely changed. I mean, when I did my first Match of the Day commentary, I was commentating for a while on radio before that, but clearly didn't quite have the profile of TV, as I came to discover at that time. I think it is a shame that people can't quite adjust themselves, but I still think it's a case of people aren't particularly used to it. And we've all grown up with voices of Brian Moore and John Motson and Alan Green, John Murray these days. People delivering football commentary in a male tone. I think it's not just a case of the voice that offends people. I think to a certain extent, some people don't trust a woman to deliver ball-by-ball commentary and to understand the offside law and to understand whether it's a good challenge or a bad challenge or whether a team's playing well or not, whether their team is playing well or not. So I certainly think that there is a mistrust involved, and I think that's only going to change as a matter of generations when my kids now are 4 and 7, when they grow up not just with a, you know, football fanatic mum, but with friends at school, girls who are into football, playing football. And I think that trust element will be with them pretty much from birth. But that's going to take a long time, really, to filter through to adulthood. So that's why I'm not so optimistic it's going to change overnight. But equally, I think as more girls come through with the passion that the likes of Michelle and I have had, and with the knowledge from going to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, if not more, games over the years, and frankly, having as much experience as any male in that situation, then I think that trust will come and I think the opportunities will arise. The broadcasters themselves need to have that confidence, and that's something I've talked about before that I really struggled with when I was doing some of those commentaries. Was confidence was massive because I felt that everyone was scrutinising me, was listening to me. I didn't just have that brashness that, sod it, I'll just do the commentary and not care. I did feel that pressure in the build-up, the lack of prep time initially. But that was my issue. That's something I had to deal with, and it took a while. But I think now things are changing, and I think it is up to us to make sure we do the best job that we can, to push ourselves forwards, to say, frankly, I'm here because I deserve to be, and I can do this. And I think the more girls and women who do that, the better the standard, the better quality, the more experience we'll have, and the more confidence we'll have. Because in this business, you cannot broadcast without confidence, or you can't do it properly. And that's a big challenge for a lot of people.
You mentioned Match of the Day there and the scrutiny that you felt under. If you had your time again, would you decide not to have so much publicity as you had going into that first game, becoming the first female commentator on Match of the Day? Did that do you any favours with hindsight?
Oh, what I would have given to have had zero publicity going into that match. I would have bitten your hand off. The main reason being because I would have been able to do my prep that week that I'd planned to do, and I actually had another shift at 5 Live, a late shift that week as well, which had to be cancelled. But I would have given anything for it. I'm not going to sit here moaning, oh, woe is me, or wasn't it stressful. I'm just telling you how it was, and that it would have been wonderful had it just been as it was supposed to be. And I think there is a misconception. People think the BBC publicised it, and it's simply not the case. All they did was put my name on a list of commentators on an ISDN sheet that week, which found its way into a national paper on the Tuesday, unfortunately, before the Saturday, which then became a huge story on the Wednesday, and it gathered pace Thursday and Friday, meaning I was the subject of a debate on all manner of phone-ins, on news programmes, on sports programmes, on 5 Live, who I worked for, and my phone literally never stopped the entire week, and my emails, and stupidly, I replied to every single email apologising for not wanting to do this interview or not wanting to do that interview because I didn't want to add any more fuel to the fire. And I spent so much time appeasing other people and politely declining interviews and things, instead of just switching everything off and just doing some prep on Fulham Blackburn, which might have calmed my nerves a little bit. But hey, that was then. That's just life. It was a major life experience. It's one to tell the grandkids. And unfortunately, that won't happen again, because other commentators are now doing the job on a regular basis and they can just get on with it. And that's how it should be. So I'm hugely grateful for that.
Jackie, how personal did it feel when people were talking to you like that? Because you touched on it just before. I think if it had been sort of any woman doing that commentary for the first time, it would have been the same reaction. But it must have, some of the things that were being said, you can't help but take them to heart, can you? And you've talked about confidence. So how do you not take these comments to heart?
Well, fortunately, Twitter wasn't around at the time, so I didn't get every single comment straight into my face, if you like, which you would get now. But then there are downsides to that, because then people haven't followed you on Twitter beforehand and know your background is in football commentary and journalism, etc. So it works both ways. But yeah, I found it really odd, some of the comments of, how can she, I think one was by Dave Bassett, how can she possibly commentate when she's never kicked a ball? That's the sort of thing that I found bizarre. Because, like you, Michelle, I was playing every week. But just because I was a female, they assumed I wasn't, which I found hilarious. But again, because there was no Twitter, there was no sort of quick comeback of going, oh, thanks for that, Dave. But, you know, my teammates and my club might disagree with you. It was just very strange. And things like, how can a woman possibly be passionate enough for football commentary? It's just all these strange things. And I thought, wow, have these people never met a female who loves football? I mean, they were talking as if they'd only been brought up by their dads, taking them to football with their brothers and playing with their mates in the playground. And that's the only thing I can think of to make them think that way, their own personal life experience. And I think that some people still go into Currys or Dixon's or Maplin's, and when they've got a technical question, probably go towards the bloke rather than the female. And I can understand that, because we've all grown up with dads being more used to fixing things than mums. And I think there's maybe something in that. But even if you think it, it's a little bit odd to express it, because it does make you look a little bit daft.
Jackie, obviously you were commentating for a long time on 5 Live. I think you went to the South Africa World Cup as one of the commentators there. But in recent years, your career has changed, hasn't it? You've become more of a presenter. You've been in front of the camera more often. Was that a conscious choice, something that happened? Or is that something that you felt you were sort of pushed into? How did it occur? And would you prefer to be behind the mic rather than in front of the camera?
That's a good question. And what actually happened was I got pregnant with my first child, Phoebe, and at around the same time, I was asked to do some presenting shifts for the BBC News Channel, which in those days was in Television Centre in West London, and you were sort of sitting across the desk when doing 5 Live. So I was doing regular commentaries on 5 Live, 5 Live Sports Extra, and I'd been asked for a while to do some presenting shifts, and I just hadn't had time. I was pretty rammed. And then one day I did have a shift, and that led to another one, and then came up the opportunity. I'm trying to think of the timeline of it, but women's football at the BBC, I was asked to do some presenting on women's football, and things just took off from there. And then having my first child, I mean, I always was doing matches on Saturdays regardless, but then having my first child after that, I found that being a mum and carry on working, it just worked better to be doing TV presenting rather than commentary, because as you probably know, match prep can, you know, TV prep and radio commentary prep, I was spending days on it before when I was single and living on my own. It was fine. I just sat at my desk all day every day, and I didn't really know what the difference was between work and play. But then suddenly having children, so I can't remember a definitive timeline to it, but certainly as more TV presenting came up while I had children, it made more sense, because frankly, it pays a lot more to do TV. You don't go into the detail. I still do a huge amount of prep for everything I do, but it's very different to actual football commentary. So yeah, it wasn't really a conscious decision at all. I love doing commentary, and it's not something that I've closed the door on at all. It's something I'd be keen to do again. It's just the way that it went. And then I got a phone call. So I was doing more and more women's football. I was doing the Euros. 2013 for BBC, then had my second child, and I got a phone call from ITV asking me if I'd like to sign a three-year contract from them to present the Euros and the World Cup and the darts. So I absolutely jumped at that. It was a brilliant thing to do and haven't really looked back from there. But as I mentioned, I'll certainly not close the door on football commentary. And it's something that I'd quite like to do, especially now my kids are at school. It might make life a little bit easier, although I've got one off sick today. So trying to do my darts prep for the weekend, it's not quite happening at the moment.
Thanks, Jackie. That's brilliant. Thank you.
Cheers, everyone. Loving the pod. It's brilliant. I've literally binge listened to every single one up and down the motorway to Manchester last week. It was so good. I love all the interviews with the Ian Dark and Nigel Pearce and all that. It's really good.
Great to hear from Jackie, who's done a lot for female broadcasters. You're listening to the All Football Commentators of Geeks podcast. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. The handles are the same, at AFC Geeks. And Crook may be off selling himself. Right now, I would imagine he's on the 17th hole of a golf course somewhere in Villamora. Tough life. Let's hear how he earned this lifestyle shortly. I caught up with him at Bournemouth last week.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.
Welcome back to the final part of All Football Commentators Are Geeks this week. Now, you may remember that in our first ever episode, Michelle gave you a little bit about her background. We called it her origin story. It's Crook's turn this week. With him being away in Portugal, sunning himself, we decided that Michelle would go and speak to him about his commentary roots prior to Bournemouth's game with Chelsea last Wednesday.
So we're sat pitch side at the Vitality Stadium. This is Crook's normal stumping ground. I come down here maybe a couple of times a season. But we need to sort of get to the bottom of you, because some people might not know that much about you, apart from the fact that you're always on TalkSport and you're always popping up writing articles. So where did it all sort of start for you? And then you can tell me the bromance between you and Sam, how that happened.
Bromance, is it?
Sam's not here either, which is quite funny, so you can say whatever you want.
Don't you have to like someone for it to be a bromance?
He's going to edit this so much.
No, I suppose I followed a fairly conventional route. I haven't got a university degree. So I did a journalism course at college and was actually fast-tracked by my lecturer onto the NCTJ postgraduate course, which is a 20-week course, basically a crash course in journalism, teaching you shorthand.
You normally need an undergrad to go on it.
You do. So I got fast-tracked onto that. And then I got my first job at the age of 18 and a half at the Slough Observer, which is actually the same newspaper where Zoe Ball started her career.
Is she there at the same time?
No, I'm not that old. But, you know, I suppose you can see our careers have taken similar paths. I was only there for 6 months, and then I just didn't like living in Slough, to be honest. No disrespect, but there's a reason they filmed The Office there. And then I went to Bournemouth, which was fantastic. Again, on a 6 months cover, because one of the girls from the sports desk was away on a course, actually, on the NCTJ course.
Ah, okay.
So I covered her for 6 months, covered Bournemouth. Actually covered the first ever game at this stadium when it was rebuilt.
How long ago was that?
Oh, so you're going back. Oh, crikey, you put me on the spot there. So that must have been around about 2002.
Really? Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was a game against Tranmere. So I covered that game here. And then I went to an agency in Portsmouth once that 6 months placement, if you could call it that, was up. MMY News Agency, which I now own. And I've been there, for 17 years.
Wow.
Primarily writing for the national papers. I've also produced some books while I've been there on Southampton, Bournemouth, Portsmouth, helped co-write Paul Parker's autobiography. I've done women's magazine features. I quite often pop up in Woman's Own and take a break about naked butlers, etc. So it's,
you know, your feminine stuff. I love it.
It's very varied. Court cases I've covered as well. Some really interesting court cases, actually. And then I broke into broadcasting. I think we've already touched upon it, because I got drunk with Sam one night.
How did you know Sam? How did you and Sam meet?
Just because we both used to cover Portsmouth at the same time.
So you become mates like that?
Yeah, basically. As you do, you get chatting to people in press boxes, and when we're hanging around the training ground waiting for interviews. And I invited him to my flat one night. We drank a bottle of whiskey.
Yeah, these stories about you two staying in the same room, they're not going away.
No, it does happen.
You're
a lot.
You're fueling them.
It does seem to happen a lot, doesn't it? And I drunkenly gave him a commentary demonstration on FIFA.
That's so funny.
And then it went from there. He gave me a game the next Saturday. That was 2005. That was the FA Cup against Gillingham.
God, you've known each other 14 years. No, well, longer than that.
Longer than that. Yeah. Blimey, you get...
scary.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, I was going to make a joke there, but I won't. And then from local radio, I did a bit of what you do on Soccer Saturday, not in Vision.
You did the ISDNs, didn't you?
I did the ISDN report.
I think we must have overlapped slightly, because I started doing the ISDNs in 2014. I've been doing 5 years.
Yeah, I think I'm. No, I think I left around about 2012. Basically,
I took your job, but I didn't.
No, basically, TalkSport then won the rights from IMG to broadcast Premier League games to overseas audiences, radio commentaries, and I went for an interview with them, and I actually turned them down originally, and then Sam convinced me that it would be a better career move for me to go and do these overseas commentaries than stay working at Soccer Saturday. And I've got to say, I think he's been right, because...
Do you think, what do you think would have happened? Do you ever have that sort of closing, sliding doors moment if you stayed at Soccer Saturday? Do you ever wonder how that might have progressed, or do you think it would have just carried on?
I think I'd have just carried on doing the ISM reports at the lower division grounds. You know what it's like there. Unless you're an ex-player, it's very difficult to get anywhere near the Premier League games. I wanted to be a commentator. That's been my aim since I was a young boy, playing Sabutio on my own.
Oh, really?
In the dining room.
So when you were doing the written stuff, the ambition was always to become a...
It was always there. And I mean, listen, who'd whether that ambition would ever have been realised without the drunken night with Sam, which, I suppose that's the million-dollar question. But I didn't see any progression at Soccer Saturday. I wanted to be a commentator. Mm. And as I say, Sam was right. I did a couple of years doing overseas commentary for TalkSport, gradually worked my way up to the main station. Again, primarily as a reporter, but I've commentated for TalkSport too. I did the World Cup last summer, which was fantastic. Again, a lifelong ambition.
It's everyone's dream, isn't it, to work at World
Cup? It is, and that was great, doing those six or seven group games. And I also did a European Championship quarter-final.
Oh, wow.
That was Croatia against Portugal, and that was for the main station. So, yeah, so far, so good. I still want to progress further, but and I still enjoy the balance. You know, people often say to me, if you got offered a full-time contract, would you take it?
I was going to ask you this.
Yeah.
I was going to say to you, sort of, we've all had that, I think we've all had that moment where you get offered a contract, but quite often it can be quite exclusive to one person. Mm-hmm. So if someone was coming to you and say, Crook, here's quite a lucrative contract for TalkSport, but you can only commentate for TalkSport all through the season, you can't do any writing or anything like that, what would you do? I know it's a theoretical question.
It would be difficult for me to turn my back on newspapers, because that was my breeding ground. Yeah. My first ever job was delivering newspapers. I got paid about £5 a week, and it used to take me 3 hours to do the round on a Sunday morning because I was reading the newspapers as I went. So I've always had a love for newspapers. I think it's a shame how the industry's gone. On the face of it, it's a dying industry, but there's still some fantastic newspaper journalists. I think newspapers have a massive role to play in the way the country is run. And in the way that decisions are made, and just, I still think it's a fantastic way of absorbing information. So I want to stay involved in that. I want to keep doing the commentary. I want to keep doing what I'm doing, really. So at the moment, I'm pretty happy.
And how do you find sort of balancing that, though, being freelance? Sort of, is there ever a point where you have to turn people down to do one or the other, or how often do you have those crazy days like you had a couple of weeks ago where you do two games in one day and things like that? How difficult is it to balance?
Actually, the most difficult thing is a midweek game. Tonight, for example, I'm not working for papers tonight, but I have had many occasions where I've been doing the updates for TalkSport while trying to file a 500-word runner for a newspaper. I remember a game here against Arsenal a couple of seasons ago. Bournemouth were 3-1 up in that game with a couple of minutes to go, and the Daily Star was saying, right, this is Arsene Wenger's obituary. Eddie Howe could be the man to take over, so I've done that. And then Arsenal scored twice in stoppage time and got a 3-3 draw. So I'm having to relay what's happening to the TalkSport audience while also frantically rewriting 500 words of copy. So it's a challenge, but again, it's something I love. I remember the old days at this ground. We didn't really use laptops back then. I sound really old, but we used to file our copy.
A little typewriter out of my suitcase.
not even a typewriter. I used to file it by the telephone. So we used to bring a telephone to the ground, plug it in. I'd have about 8 newspapers that I'd be working for, and I'd pick up the phone, and off the top of my head, I'd file a 200-word report for the Mail on Sunday, put the phone down. I'd then file 500 words for the News of the World, put the phone down. I'd then file 400 words for the Press Association.
Who was there under the phone? Was it like an automated thing?
They had a designated office in Leeds. I think it was set up by the Press Association, but they were basically serving all the different national newspapers.
So cool. But
that was a great grounding, and I think actually it helps me as a broadcaster, because I have the ability to quickly relay what I'm seeing in front of me.
Mm.
without the need to necessarily write it all down.
And you don't have to sit there and... It was all last night. Sorry, it's a full-on conversation between a steward and a young man in front of us. No, you're fine. Carry on, guys. It is a football ground. I was going to say, for you and Sam, there's not a huge age difference between us, but is there sort of that generational thing where reporters my age coming through now are completely oblivious to that sort of world where there weren't laptops on the benches in the press box, where it was literally just microphones and notepads? You know, you've seen it change so much.
Have
you noticed this sort of my generation coming through now, they're completely oblivious to that?
Yeah, and I think if you asked a modern newspaper journalist now to file six newspaper reports off the top of his head, he'd probably struggle. And listen, I might even struggle now because I'm so used to having six different templates open on my laptop if I need to. And the other skill that I've got that most modern journalists don't have is shorthand, because part of that postgraduate course was shorthand, which was every day, 7:30 a.m. we were in there for an hour,
practicing
5 days a week in a shorthand lesson. And one of the proudest things I ever achieved was getting my 100 words a minute shorthand. Sadly, I don't really use it now because, again, we record on our phones, we use dictaphones.
Can you do 100 words a minute?
I couldn't do 50. Wow. Which is a shame because, again, I think, particularly for court reporting, you still can't really cover a court case without shorthand. So I think, again, it's a dying art and a skill that I would encourage young wannabe reporters to get under their belt if they possibly can, because I do still think there are times when it can be useful.
Sadly out of time for another week. Thank you very much to Jackie Oakley, to John Akers, to Crook for taking time off the golf course to help us write the script this week. Thanks to Michelle as well. We'll all be back next week together when we will have a very special guest joining us. Thanks for now, and if you want to get in touch, you can do on Instagram or via Twitter. It's at AFCGeeks on both platforms.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.